I'd like to read to you tonight from one of Swami Ramdas's writings entitled Divine Voice and Guidance. Inner voice speaks in the devotee when he has surrendered up his body, mind, and soul into the keeping of the divine who dwells within him. In this state of surrender, this body becomes the willing instrument. The mind is enlightened with divine radiance, and the soul unites and identifies with Supreme Spirit. Now God's guidance is felt at every step, and the devotee's life becomes a spontaneous expression of divinity in all its modes of activity. His consciousness becomes one with the universal consciousness, and he transcends the limitations of time and space. His vision becomes all-inclusive and all-embracing. The petty distinctions which held sway on him in his days of ignorance dissolve in the infinite vastness of this exalted spiritual experience. Thus, equality of vision becomes the background of the devotee's life, and this outlook illumines his entire external life. Sometimes, when a devotee who is struggling for a complete surrender confronts a difficult problem and he has to arrive at a definite decision and plan for action, he fails to interpret rightly what God wills him to do. Here the devotee is sorely puzzled, becomes restless and worried over the solution. This is because the devotee's reasoning faculty is still at work, creating doubt and vacillation, even when the inner voice has spoken and given a clear guidance. The ego raises its hood and seeks to confuse his mind. Here the way out of the difficulty is to adopt an attitude of perfect reliance on and resignation to the divine will, and to make the mind still and serene, so that the divine spirit within may point out emphatically a clear-cut line of thought and action. Often, even after a particular decision is reached, according to the command from the divine, should the immediate results prove to be apparently harmful or undesirable, doubt assails the devotee, and he is led to think that his decision is wrong. He then unwisely withdraws or gives up halfway the plan of action upon which he had embarked. He is unable to see his move as willed by the higher power would ultimately produce the most beneficial effect for all concerned. Now the question is, how can one understand whether a certain prompting the devotee gets is either from the divine or from the ego? For this, there is no external way of test. When the heart of the devotee is in perfect attunement with the divine, and he is surcharged with the peace of the eternal, the voice directs and there is no mistake. It is a sense of separation from the immortal spirit that prevents the devotee from receiving or recognizing real guidance from him, and hence arises uncertainty and confusion. So the devotee should live at all times in uninterrupted communion with and the resultant surrender to the divine. He should offer himself to God within so thoroughly that by his power and grace the devotee's life is transformed in all its aspects, and his omnipresence and all controlling power is experienced by him. He becomes the mold, as it were, into which the divine pours himself, converting him into his very expression and image. As he has attained divine vision and beholds his own self in all and as all, he becomes a powerful force for awakening and guiding humanity to the goal of spiritual liberation and beatitude. His touch and sight act like the magic causing to reveal the light and peace of the divine in all who come in his contact. Such a one is a rare blessing on earth. He brings unity, goodwill, peace and harmony on it. Every moment belongs to God. Endeavor to keep your mind dedicated to his feet. God, the ocean of mercy, who ever blessed the world, pours out his grace at all times. It is incumbent on man to consider everything that happens to be for the best. For the best denoting what is most helpful towards the realization of the divine, the realization of the fullness of bliss. Who are truly wealthy? Those who are possessed of the supreme treasure, they alone are really rich and live in abundance. Poor and destitute must be called the man in whose heart the remembrance of God abides not. To depend solely on him is man's one and only duty. Let his name be ever with you. Imperceptibly, relentlessly, time is creeping away. It is possible to practice God's name under the most adverse circumstances. He causes everything to happen and is therefore ever near. In whatever state he keeps anyone at any time, it is all for the good. For verily, everything is ordered by him, is of him. Relative happiness, which is happiness depending on anything or anyone, must end in grief. It is man's duty to meditate on God, who is peace itself. Without having recourse to that which aids the remembrance of God, there can be no peace. Have you not seen what life in this world is? The one to be loved is God. In him is everything. Him you must try to find. The Lord's is the body. The Lord's is the mind. The Lord's is all mankind. Serving anyone is his service only. Endeavor to keep your mind always elevated. Is there ever a time when he is invisible? The discovery of this is all that is wanting. By doing service, heart and mind are purified. Be convinced of this. To engage in service is a very powerful sadhana. Do not become impatient. Rather, serve your people with the utmost calm and have a kind word for everyone. Whenever you say or do anything wrong, beg to be forgiven and try your best not to let a similar error occur in future. Even though others may be unjust to you, you yourself should neither do nor say anything unseemly. The stream of godly thoughts is the path that leads to the exhaustion of karma. So long as the goal has not been reached, one is bound to reap the consequences of right action, wrong action, and inaction, according to karma, the law of cause and effect. Where God may place you at any time and under whatever circumstances, recollect that it is all for the best. Endeavor to go through life, leaving your burdens in his hands. He is the preserver. He is the guide. He is the all-in-all. At all times, let forbearance be your norm. Say to yourself, Lord, everything thou doest is for the highest good. Pray for the power of endurance. Nothing happens that is not an expression of God's grace. Verily, all is his grace. Anchored in patience, enduring everything, abide by his name and live joyously. All this which is his creation is under his dispensation, in his presence, and is he. That's a tremendous article. We have mentioned from time to time the seeming state of chaos in the world today, the tremendous upheaval. Years ago, there was a master who went into silence. That silence was to last only 1 year. At the end of that year, he was going to speak a word which would cause a tremendous upheaval in the world, where the forces of good and evil, the Battle of Armageddon or the Battle of Kurukshetra, would commence to take place. There would be tremendous reaching out for the Spirit by those whose hearts were pure, who wanted great enlightenment, who wanted their oneness with God. And on the other hand, there would be tremendous opposition by the forces which were trying to keep them from reaching their goal, trying to keep everything going away from God. We have but to look around us today to see the manifestation of this. This man, at the end of this year, did not, so-called, break his silence. He continued on year after year in his so-called Mona, which is spelled A-M-A-U-N-A, always keeping his disciples glued to him. He was a tremendous saint of love. Love was the keynote to everything. He didn't teach them specific lessons. He taught them love. And he kept promising them that one day, when God directed him to, that he would break his silence. The God was himself, because he said that he was the Savior, that he was the Ancient One, that he was the Avatar, come in this age to take all unto himself. So year after year went by. The disciples grew in number. They became terrifically glued to the master, and he told them that all that they had to do was to hang on to his daemon, or the hem of his robe, and he would take them to God. In the meantime, he asked them to serve him and to serve him in everyone they met. And so this they did. And the master had tremendous power. He had tremendous vision. But through all of this, he didn't keep complete mona or silence, because to do that means to retire within yourself. You see, even the flutter of an eyelash brings with it its corresponding vibration and therefore reaction. So he used his fingers. He used an alphabet board to communicate with his disciples. And finally, one of the great women saints in India, in a discussion with me one day, told me with her own lips that he had summoned her to his ashram, and that rather than maintaining mona or silence, he had spoken to her and had asked her to leave her guru and to come with him. There are many stories told, but the final conclusion, or at least the seeming conclusion to this particular story, is that the master passed on, left the body, without saying that word which would commence the tremendous upheaval, the tremendous reaching out for enlightenment. Someone else spoke that word, and that word was spoken on December 28, 1957. I was there. And immediately, the forces were set in action. The individual who spoke the word paid the biggest price of all. But this had to come to be, and great visions had been given, that at this time, which was the turn of the cycle, when all must go back to God, the vision came that everything had been going out from God. Now, of course, it returns, but man's consciousness had descended into the age of darkness, the age of Kali Yuga. During that age of darkness, it is said that Jesus the Christ came to earth, that he was born the Son of Man, that the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. And he came and through his own exemplary life showed us the way which every man must go, if he is to reach his oneness with the divine. But there was one difference, you see, because in the Christian terminology, the whole idea was that this one man, Jesus the Christ, who was crucified on a wooden cross, so the story goes historically, paid the sins, atoned for all mankind for all time to come. It was a question of vicarious atonement. And all that had to be done by any of his disciples in the future was to accept him as their Lord and Savior, and they would reach salvation. Strangely enough, there are many people who still believe that today. Now, the basis of that is certainly true, but the truth of it is contained not only in one man who lived 2,000 years ago, but in every man. Because every man is born the Son of Man. And every man must be crucified on his own cross, which is his own body, in order that he might attain enlightenment, might become the Christed One, the Son of God. This business of this phrase, that this is the beginning of the last time when all must go back to God, is a tremendous thing. And in vision I was shown that this is true, that God himself had taken form on this earth, both as the form of the Father and as the Mother. And that all of the great ones who had ever lived, that whose names have come down in history as being the great leaders in the spiritual field, have again taken on form and have dwelt among us, in order that this tremendous impetus of going away from God might be swung around and redirected upwardly, so that all may come to realize the light and the wisdom and the power and the love of God. So we have a tremendous battle going on in the world today. I have seen a great deal of it in my lifetime. I have had to deal with a great deal of it in my lifetime. I have had to deal with it within the confines of my own soul. because every man's soul is a battleground. You are caught up between these positive and negative forces, these so-called two thieves of your cross, one good and one evil, and in this battle that the soul has to go through. And it's a tremendous experience. And sometimes you find it difficult, even as it says in this article, to know which way to turn. You try your best. You hang on to God with everything you can. And you think you make a wrong decision because you're not in a normal state of consciousness at all. And try as you will to hear the voice of God, then something seems to turn out that isn't as you had anticipated it would be, inasmuch as you thought you had followed God's voice. Then a terrible fear comes inside of you. And you think, what have I done? What have I done? Now am I going to be lost? Who will save me? I have not followed what God has taught me, but I have followed, I have taken a misstep, and I'm following this devil, this Satan, that has been kept so predominantly before my mind at all times. We have had this idea of Satan, of the devil, ingrained in our consciousness to the degree where it is an illness, and it is a terrible crime for anybody to have committed against the human race. It is terrible. And we find all over the world, but particularly here in America, an uprising, even of the forces of Christianity, one against the other. Those forces that still believe in the historical version of the Bible, that Jesus was the only begotten Son of God, that he is the only one who ever came to earth, who ever will come to earth, that has the power to save us from sin. On the other hand, we have enlightened people who have paid the necessary price to know the truth behind the parables. These see God everywhere. They love God in every form that dwells among them. Their mind, their consciousness is not dwelling upon the satanic, the evil force, but upon God alone. There are many doubts created in man. But this is man's responsibility, not God's. By whatever name you want to call him, you have to realize that one who is your life, who is your very self. And if you quibble with names, if you quibble with words, this is a distraction by this opposing force within yourself, which is none other than your own human ego, which has no basis in truth or in fact. It is pure delusion. It comes as a temptation. Just visualize the horns on it. See it with the pitchfork and the tail, because that indeed is what it is. It is that beast that we have spoken about before, that animal nature of man, that one that doesn't want to surrender his place on the throne, that tries to take over the throne of God to keep the spiritual aspirin from seeking the light. I don't care by what means you find your oneness with God, what path you seek to follow. Stay with it. Put your attention, if you don't like the word God, if you don't like the word Christ, if you don't like any other word, then give it this tremendous power that is your very self, your very life, whatever name you choose, and put your mind upon it and act and do as you should, and you will surely find your enlightenment. You will remember that Walt Whitman repeated his own name and attained total enlightenment. Ram Dass repeated just the name of God. Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. Victory to God, victory to God. His guru, who happened to be his human father, gave him the mantra which was handed to him to give his son, and at that time it was just Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. Jai Jai Ram. But Ram Dass, in all of his wisdom, put the word Om in front of, because that was the creative word. That's the word that is God. It is the word that first came out of God. It is the word that sustains whatever comes out of God, this creation, this manifestation of his very self. And it is also that word that will take you back to God. If you will listen inside of yourself to this word Om, you will hear it without any question of a doubt. It isn't something that you hear with the outer ear. You hear it with the inner ear. And as you tune your consciousness to it and become one with it, it will carry you on the waves of this sound right back to the heart of God within yourself. The things that are being done in the name of Christ, of Christianity, by those who believe in the historical Christ, to those who believe in the truth and know the truth of God because they have paid the price, is unbelievable. The persecution, the absolute beating down, is beyond human belief. I had a call this morning from an 80-year-old woman, and she is a tremendous devotee. And she said to me, "Mother, do you think that I am a Christian?" I said, "I most certainly do." Every day of her life she is meditating upon God. Her skin glows with the light of God. The light of God is in her eyes. Every day, even in her 80s, she gets up and she does her hatha yoga exercises. She meditates. She is a vegetarian. She lives the life. And according to her own little phraseology, she listens to the Spirit. The Spirit speaks to her, says she. And when she speaks of the Spirit, she's speaking of God Himself, because she never makes a move without she listens to that inner spirit. It so happened that her sister was of the Orthodox faith, and she really believed in it all the way. Well, when she passed on, she left all of her property to the church, but with the provision that the home which she had, and which her sister had at times lived in, should be left to this sister for the duration of her lifetime, that the church could never touch it. And that then at her passing, it would revert to the church. So not long ago, she called me with another problem. The church wanted the house, which is fully furnished now, and they wanted to give her $50 a month and have her move out. So what did I think of it? I said, "No." I said, "I don't think that's fair, because I don't care who is looking for a home today. You can't find any sort of a place for $50 a month, and certainly not furnished, and this is a nice home." I said, "Somebody is selling you short." So I said, "I would go deep within and let God guide and direct me. If you feel directed to accept their offer, then ask Him what you should settle for, because certainly that is far too less. You couldn't possibly live on it. It would be of almost no value to you." So I said, "If you're going to do it, ask them for a much larger sum." So anyway, she called me later and said that she had decided she was just going to stay there. And while she didn't have much money for taxes, that she felt at her time of life that she needed roots someplace, and that somehow God would make it possible for her to pay the taxes and to get along. So this she continued to do. So then a couple other members of the family moved in, and they are also the Orthodox faith. So they started berating her because she was unwilling to give up the home to the church. They had told her that because she believes in God and the Christ the way she does, that she is not a Christian. And they have badgered her and bullied her until she got a spark up and she says, "I told them I am a Christian. Don't you think I'm right in telling them that?" And I said, "I most certainly do. I'm just going to stick with it," she says. "I'm just going to stick with it. They're not going to get me down." And I said, "That is the way." Now, I know of another case where the same persecution is going on, and the individual involved is so persecuted, so condemned, so everything you can imagine is placed and heaped upon this individual. There are prayers being said by whole congregations against this individual. That nerve paralysis is setting in. And this is Christianity, for God's sakes. You know, it makes you shudder when you think what man does in the name of God. I hope that we will never be bigoted, that we will never be narrow that way. Each man, as I've said a million times, is entitled. It is his inalienable right to worship God in his own way, as God within directs him to. And these people who are constantly pointing the finger and condemning others should remember that Jesus himself said that he came not to save the self-righteous, but sinners. I heard part of a program that Billy Graham gave last evening about angels. He's a wonderful speaker, this man. And he does a tremendous job in getting people at least to start on the path to God. But still, there is the tremendous emphasis on sin. You're a miserable sinner. He talked about angels. And he talked about the angels of Satan and the angels of God. And he said there's so much emphasis now on the workings of the devil. He said there was book after book after book published about these satanic cults He said he himself wrote a book about Satan, but he said it wasn't nearly as good as the rest of them, so he wasn't going to publish it. So anyway, he said, and I quote, he said, "Why do we not think of the angels on our side? Why are we so fearful of the angels of Satan, of the angels of the devil? Why are we constantly pointing the finger at every single human being and telling them, in effect, that they are angels of Satan?" He said, there's a tremendous army of angels on God's side. But he said, man, or God has made man above the angels, because man alone comes back to this earth for the purpose of realizing who and what he is on God. And the angels stand guard over him. Remember that it says in one place there, that when these things are all around you, that if you keep your faith in God, the 10,000 will fall by your side, and yet not one hair of your head shall be touched. We must have faith. We must pursue our path. God needs God-realized souls as they have never been needed before in the history of mankind. Let us not be as some are, that go out and try to teach without any God-realization of their own. It is the blind leading the blind. I want each and every one of you here, and there is nothing that I won't do to help you within my strength and within my power, to find God within yourself, to become a light and to spread that light of God throughout the world, to combat some of this that is going on. It is so dreadfully, so terrifically needed, so desperately needed. What right does any man have to destroy another man's life, his mind, even to the point of bringing him to a state of paralysis because he doesn't happen to believe in Jesus the Christ the same way he does, even though he believes in Jesus the Christ? This is absolutely terrible. It's ridiculous. What right does anyone have to point the finger at anyone? I teach love all the time. I give love. There isn't anyone in this world that I don't see God in. I don't care what I get from them, how much they might persecute and revile me. I hate the things which some of them do. I hate some of the things which are happening. But I see God in that form. I love God in that form, and I will do anything I can to help to bring that one to the light if they will only let me, God be willing, because I myself can do nothing. It is my Father who doeth the works. But even when I do things which are without malice aforethought, which are in accordance with God's direction for the highest good of whomever I happen to be doing it for, still the suspicion comes that I'm doing it for my own gains, to get even or get back with somebody, at somebody. It's a fantastic spot to be in. You have no idea. I'm saying all of this because I am urging you to meditate as often as possible, to keep your attention fully fixed upon God, to obey His laws, to walk the way of the Christ, to get this light within yourself, to find your real self. That enlightened one who sits on the throne of your consciousness and who is at the very center of your heart, your life, your being. Because God alone is, and God alone is love. It is man who is doing all this. As I've made the statement before, God made man and man has made religion. But with the Christian faith, the way it is, you see, with the only begotten Son of God coming just 2,000 years ago, forget all the rest of the sons of God that had come before. This is rather a difficult feat at this present time now. But it can be and it must be, because it is the truth. It is the truth. There are teachers coming here by the hundreds. I saw a whole list of them the other day. It was presented to me, and I was asked to sponsor these people. I looked down the list and I recognized a few of them. And believe me, from what I know from personal experience and contact with others who have been with these people, I wouldn't touch them with a 20-foot pole. And yet, people come here and ask me to sponsor such things. I am only interested in sponsoring one thing, and that is God within you. I am only interested in keeping your attention upon one thing, and that is God within yourself. I want only that and nothing else. Nothing else at all. If I seem to be egotistical in my stress and strain to keep you glued to God in this form, it is not an ego trip, I can assure you. It is for your sake alone, because as the example I've cited before, if you want to study any subject on earth, I don't care what it is, you cannot have two teachers at one side, at one time, and come out with the truth, because you will wind up in a state of confusion, whether it be science or mathematics or English or geometry or whatever. You have one teacher at a time, but you must have a teacher, just as you have a teacher to teach you reading, writing, arithmetic, spelling, and gradually all of the arts and sciences as you go along. Also, on the spiritual path, you must have a teacher to teach you the way. But unless that teacher has been the way, has actually gone through the experiences necessary to show you the way, to help you and guide you when certain developments come within your consciousness and within your being, when you put your feet on the spiritual path, you won't get any place, and you can get into trouble. It is very difficult to know a true guru. There is a master that is traveling all over the United States and has been in Hawaii, whom I met personally in India the last time I was there. And he's making a big splash. Everybody's being very impressed. He's spreading, starting ashrams all over the place. Somebody has given him a lot of money to build a big ashram headquarters in America, all this and that and the other thing. And yet I personally know people who have gone to visit him at his ashram. I have personally met him myself. And I know that he uses powers. He works with the Shakti force in the spine. And this can be very, very dangerous unless the individual is ready for it. As I told the story on Sunday, your being can be shattered. You can die. And also somebody told me that they were in one of his meetings in a foreign country, and they were sitting there just thinking of how tremendous it was to be one with all of the brothers and sisters in the room, that everyone was God, and all of a sudden he came along and pushed their heads back when they were in this deep state of consciousness, and it almost ruined them. This is a true master? Don't believe it. And how can you tell from the outside? Because it goes from word to mouth. Oh, have you heard so-and-so? He's great. He did a lot for me. Let's go and hear this one. Let's go and hear that one. And the person that's starting out on the path hasn't the faintest idea of what he's getting into. I am not jealous of the prerogatives of other gurus, if those gurus be true. Master once made the statement that the disciples did the master a great disservice when they always said, my guru is the greatest in the world, my guru is greater than yours, because he said, any guru who is a true guru is the same in God. He may have gone by a different path, but his consciousness of the truth, his oneness with God, is the same. And that's exactly the way I feel. But I don't like frauds. And so with everything within me, I try to protect those who come to me from such circumstances, such people, and getting themselves involved in situations where there will be trouble. And it will retard and perhaps stop for this incarnation their progress on the path. I don't do this for myself. I do it for you. And you alone. I want you to know that with everything that's in me. I found a couple of interesting things here. There are many people who, after they've been with the guru a while, start to have doubts. I can think of a case where there was very, very great closeness between myself and a certain disciple. And all of a sudden, God arranged for something to happen for the simple reason that it was time for this devotee to go to a new level of consciousness, to find within themselves the power of overcoming. And they were having a terrible time about it. So anyway, I'd like to read this to you. It says, compassion, human and divine. From the human point of view, to show compassion means to express your feelings of sympathy, love, consideration toward others. It means to feel for others, to extend a helping hand to those who need it. The compassion of the master sets the standard for others. In his understanding that all are one and that he is one with all, he thinks of others and helps them as naturally as the ordinary man thinks of and helps himself. This highest form of compassion, which is exercised by the master, is usually, however, not understood or appreciated by the seeker who is green to the ways of the true guide. This divine compassion consists in deliberately not expressing any trace of compassion toward his close disciples. It often happens that as the relationship between master and disciple grows, the master begins to withdraw his attention from the disciple and show him nothing but indifference. Just as the lover's love for his master is becoming predominant in his life, the master no longer showers him with loving remembrance, no longer has kind words for his efforts, no longer seems to care at all about this disciple's progress. While at an earlier time the master was full of concern and taking an active part in guiding the disciple, now he seems almost callously forgetful of him, or even to be displeased with him. At this stage, the seeker may have some serious second thoughts about his master, seeing him as cruel in his disregard for his welfare. The seeker suffers terrible pangs of separation and longing at this point, and he feels lost and abandoned by the one whom he trusted implicitly. Yet all this is a necessary part of the plan of the master. The whole purpose of the master-disciple relationship is to create such tremendous longing in the disciple that his ego is worn down to nothing. Only then is he ready to experience the fullness of the ocean of reality. Only then can he transcend the limitations of his ego consciousness to become one with the infinite consciousness of the master. Throughout it all, the master inwardly guides his lover and sustains him with constant loving help, which is hidden from the lover's awareness. Naturally, for the lover is most dear to the master, but for the lover's own good, the honeymoon must end so that his longing to see the master as he really is will grow to the necessary intensity. In the compassion which springs from his all-embracing wisdom, the master turns his back on his lover in order to make him long for the master all the more. Only the master could create that terrible burning in the lover's heart, and only true divine compassion could make the master act to perfection the part of the indifferent beloved, while all the time caring for his devotee with a boundless love beyond human imagination. This is great truth. I myself experienced, and I know exactly the feeling, because at one point, all of a sudden, having been glued to my guru for 18 years, where we truly had a spiritual love affair. There was nothing personal in the relationship at all, because he was down there, I was up here. I've seen him 12 times in my life, and by that I mean, like, sometimes I'd go down there and be down there for a week or two, but 12 separate times in my life is all I've ever seen him. Yep, that romance was there. That eternal bondage of the soul, of binding together, it was a tremendous marriage. And I remember after his passing, I was going down the hill to pick up my robe for the funeral services, and one of the devotees from out of another town had driven me down, and she said, "How long have you been with the master?" I said, 27 years. She said, "No wonder you look so much like him when you have been married to him for so long." And this is true. This is the sort of relationship I had. Yet all of a sudden, at one point, there was nothing. He just cut me off like that. And I was devastated. I had been paralyzed before, and he had healed me totally, and yet that devastation of being cut off from him was so great that the paralysis returned. And so, on the night then, when finally he saw me, he healed me of it. It was just like, all of a sudden, after he started working on me, like molten lead running through every vein in my body, it didn't take 5 minutes for him to put everything into action again. But nevertheless, I lost my train of thought here. This went on, and it wasn't until I saw him the next evening that he questioned me very closely about everything that I had gone through. And I told him of this tremendous devastation. I said, "What did I do?" I said, "I love you with everything I have inside of me. There is nothing I wouldn't do for you. I would go to the farthest corner of the earth. I would die for you. Such is my love for God in you." And he said to me a very strange thing. "If you had not been affected, I could not have seen you again." And I didn't ask him what he meant. To this day, there it is. But for 3 years, I went through this. 3 long years. Until finally, I got it back. Now, this was the most tremendous test. I could have walked out on it. I could have given in to the doubts that came, the torture that came. I could have said that he turned his back on me, that he was through with me, and I could have sought someone else, but thank God I didn't. Because I stuck it out, I toughed it out, until I got back what I had before. Only it wasn't like I had before. It was so much greater, so much more perfect in every detail than I can possibly tell you about. It was so perfect that it took me to the feet of another master who put me through the crucifixion in order that I might gain my final enlightenment. And my life was very little to pay for him, and it was he whom I thought I was paying it for, because he had saved my life so many times. I had given it to him, and he had accepted it. He took it. And so out of it all, I came to this point. Whatever it may be, God alone knows. I know not. I only know that with everything I am, I belong to the Lord. With every breath I draw, I serve him. That I love him in every form that comes before me. That there is nothing that he would ask of me that I would not do. And I would ask each and every one of you to examine your own conscience, your own hearts, and ask yourselves if that is true of you. You come and you say you want God realization. Are you willing to give your life for Christ? Are you willing to give up yourself in order that you may find yourself? Are you willing to go through every test, every single thing that is required of you in order to find this oneness with God? Or are you just complaining about every little thing? Is your mind working to find fault with this and that? Is it filled with doubts? It should be at that source of all wisdom. It should be on that fountain of all love. God himself, the source of all. And don't forget that he is seated in your heart. He is your very life, your real self. And still, you fail to realize that. You're willing to settle for the little self that will give you nothing but grief and sorrow and doubt and ashes in the end. One of the best known signs of the divinity of a master is his humanity. Real spiritual advancement makes a person more fully human, not more removed from humanity. The advanced saint or yogi may be so absorbed in his inner experiences that he can't relate to the mundane details of the gross plane. But the perfect master is perfectly human. Many people expect aloofness in a guru. Look for warmth instead. Many people expect a perfect master to be serenely oblivious to the world. Look instead for an uncanny awareness of everything around him. Many expect a somber countenance charged with the seriousness of the struggle of the spiritual path. Look instead for one who can be both appropriately grave and blissfully lighthearted as the occasion demands. A perfect master has an enlivening sense of humor and a superhuman consideration for your own very human worries and problems. He is alive to every look in your eyes, every tone of your voice, every hope, every wish, every sadness, and every joy. He cares for you and for your ultimate happiness as would the most loving grandmother. And he shows his care with unimagined tenderness in a thousand unexpected ways. A God-realized master has plumbed the most esoteric mysteries of the universe. And he experiences a world of infinite consciousness which is absolutely unknown to the ordinary man. Many seekers feel that such a master would be totally out of their reach, preoccupied and unconcerned with them. But if he is indeed divine, he will show you what it is to be truly human. That's also very interesting. I had something else marked here, but I don't know. The signs of perfection. Certain outer signs are intimately tied to the inner state of spiritual perfection. The perfect master not only experiences oneness with God, but also oneness with everything. This means that he is not found drowned in the experience of God awareness, Unresponsive to the world around him, seeing himself in everyone, he responds to each person's needs as if they were his own. Because his infinite experience of God pervades everything, when the perfect master embraces or feeds another person, his realization is simply that he is embracing or feeding himself. One invariable manifestation of this supreme experience is the spontaneity of love that such a one feels and expresses toward all beings in creation. To him, nothing is essentially more attractive or repulsive than anything else. All the different opposite sides of life, which we know in duality, good and bad, beauty and ugliness, sinner and saint, are to the perfect master merely different expressions of himself. Another sign of perfection is the unmistakable atmosphere of bliss that radiates from and surrounds the God-realized master. Such a guide simultaneously enjoys infinite bliss while also experiencing infinite suffering. He experiences bliss because of his own union with God and his absolute freedom from all limitations. He experiences suffering in others who are imprisoned in the ignorance of not knowing that they in reality are also one with God. Yet however intense the suffering of the Sadguru, its acuteness is nullified or at least subdued by his unbroken experience of bliss. Consequently, the perfect master can appear blissfully calm and radiant even in the face of intense inner suffering on behalf of those in illusion. The third major sign of perfection is the ability to adapt to any and every level of humanity. The master who has reached the highest plane is equally at home at the lowest. He is as comfortable in a village hut as on a throne. With royalty, he is regal. With the poor, he is simple. With scholars, he is learned. And with children, he is disarmingly childlike and radiantly happy. The perfect master is perfect at every level. Everything that I have read you is absolutely true. You shouldn't accept anyone that comes along on the strength of their own idea, their own self-perfection. You should go within and meditate. You should make yourself aware of these signs. That's why I've read them to you, so that you may know for yourself what these signs are, because they are there and they are true. The master tests the disciple in many ways. I remember when I first went to India, I had visions of spending long hours in meditation, of doing certain types of sadhana. I didn't know what to expect from Swami Ram Dass, because I didn't go over there really to get my God realization from him. I went over there on my master's behalf because of my great love for him and my great concern for his work. And so I said to Papa one day, "Papa, what would you like us to do?" And he looked at me and he said, "Ram Dass wishes that you would do nothing." And that stopped me. I thought, what am I supposed to do? Sit here with hands folded, just do nothing? That doesn't seem very wise or very smart. How am I going to get to God that way? But I took it inside of myself and I meditated on it. All of a sudden the answer came. He didn't want me, the human ego, to do anything. He wanted me to relinquish it totally, absolutely, and to let God, who is the very life, the dweller in this form, do all things through me and for me. Now this was a tremendous realization. There's a story told about a devotee who heard about a very great saint. He was supposed to be one of the greatest that had ever lived. And he thought if he could only go to this saint to become his devotee, that he would get his God realization in a hurry. So he made inquiries as to where he could be found. And he did whatever was necessary in order to finally come before him. And he asked the saint if he would accept him as a devotee, and the saint said yes. He said, "Master, what would you like me to do?" He said, "Oh," he said, "I would like you to keep my place clean and cook my meals." So the devotee thought that was rather strange. Was he not going to tell him to do certain sadhanas? Was he not going to tell him to meditate? Was he not going to tell him to read spiritual scripture and sacred books, things of this nature? But anyway, he was just a beginner on the path, and he thought the master, being as great as he was, must surely know what he was doing. So he started in, and he swept the floor, and he got the master's meals. And day after day and day after day went on, and still the same thing happened. And the devotee felt he was getting nowhere at all. So finally, at the end of 6 months, he went and he said, "Reverend Sir," He said, I have been with you for 6 months now, and while I'm very happy to sweep your floor and keep your place clean and cook your meals, could I deign to ask the master if he would help me just a little bit toward my enlightenment? And the master said, ah, yes, he said, maybe you had better include cleaning around the outside of the house. And so the disciple was quite chagrined to think that he had even asked a question, and he went around and he picked up everything in the yard, and he kept the grass mowed and, or cut to the side, which they do over there, kept everything neat and trim. And he kept on and on and on, doing the cooking, waiting on the master, taking care of his clothes, keeping the place clean, keeping the grounds clean, and still he wasn't doing anything. And he'd almost come to the point of giving up, and he'd gotten sort of used to this lazy life, and he thought, oh, well, I guess it really isn't very important as to whether I get it or not. I'm at the feet of a great master, and if this is what he wants, I might just as well do what he wants me to. But still there was that feeble thought, that little spark yet that was still not satisfied with what the master was doing. So finally he made one last feeble attempt. And he went before the master and he said, Master, I've been with you 2 years now. You have not directed me to do one thing that to me seems to bring me any closer to God. I have cooked your meals. I have kept your place clean. I have washed your clothes. I have cleaned around the yard. I've done everything you have. But still, you have not taught me anything about attaining God. And the master looked into his eyes, and his eyes all of a sudden glowed. He says, my son, what is there to attain when there's just like when it is just like this? And he took off his chapel, and he touched him on the forehead, and the man went into a state of tremendous bliss. He got his realization like that. Do you get the point of that story? It is obedience to God and the Guru until that ego no longer raises its head, no longer wants anything but to obey God and the Guru. When you are rid of your own desires, of your own reaching out, of your own longings, when you have subjected yourself fully to the will of God, whatever it may be, then the Master will touch you. And God is the Master. He is the supreme and only Guru of the whole universe. He will reach out and touch you, and you will find out who and what you really are. And this enlightenment will come, and to your everlasting wonder and delight, you will find that you are He.